Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome back to Get It Off Your Breasts Season 3. I'm Leanna Bird, and myself and Emma Gannon are really excited this week to welcome our very first male guest on the podcast. Now, you may know this young man as one half of Rizzle Kicks, or as a brilliant actor, or indeed soon as a writer. I first met him on a panel that I was on with him about women in music, and I have to say I was so impressed by his intelligent and nuanced view on feminism and about how he talked about being brought up by an incredibly strong woman, his mother, and the influence and effect that had on him. Both Emma, myself, and our producer Shola all agreed that he would be a brilliant person to pop our male guest Cherry on this, our beloved podcast. And so we are delighted to welcome this week Jordan Stevens. So thank you so much, Jordan, for coming. We are sitting in my flat at the moment. And
honoured.
You were a little bit late, a little bit flummoxed.
Why did you have to just drop me in there? Listen, I honestly...
It's a nice summer's day. We don't blame you.
See, this is the thing. You have that. You believe in it that I was just like running around Primrose Hill, just having a laugh. Like, I wasn't. I genuinely have... I'm very poor organisationally. It's been my target of this year.
I'm now imagining you like on Primrose Hill, like just doing roly polies down and like losing track of the time.
I was working. I genuinely thought, this is more ridiculous, that it was 3 hours after this. I apologize. I feel like I can't tell the time.
We are really grateful.
Yeah, thank
and we're
you.
So happy to have you here, and so happy that you are our first male guest as
Love
well. And as our guest, we would like to invite you first, as we always do, to get something off your breasts or chest this week.
Yeah. Pecs.
What would you like to get off your pecs?
So I think what I would like to talk about is Hollywood romance.
Ooh.
Yes. So not necessarily Hollywood romance in that it's like an unrealistic depiction of what love really is. That, but more importantly, in my mind, the fact that I think there's a large proportion of people who find love actually incredibly difficult, and we have a conventional idea based off of what we've seen and heard, and also history to an extent, a lot of it's religious, on how to love. And it's, if you've been brought up in an environment where you haven't necessarily seen it in a conventional way, or if you haven't seen your idea of love reflected, you could often fall into a place where you're seen as, I mean, the word aggressor sounds a bit deep, but like there's a sense of shame that you don't understand something that everyone seems to get. Mm. So my feeling is that like there would be more harmony potentially, especially in the formative years of our lives, or when we start to understand the importance of relationships and the importance of having another person there, or more than one person there, depending on how you look at things. And I don't know, I just feel as though there was quite rigid boundaries and rules that sometimes it feels like the rules or the concepts come before the understanding of a person. And I often see people torn apart, or incredibly hurt, or feel, you know, betrayed. There's like, there's all types of things with a lot of responsibilities that you have to carry. And I really do believe that love ultimately is one of respect and trust and togetherness and presence and being emotionally attentive and just being someone's kind of rock and consistent, constant, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think that, yeah, I don't know, I've grown up watching myself and other people in certain scenarios where they might find the route to their own harmony harder, because they are categorized as unable to love, or not a good person. When I think, especially with love, more so than other things, there's a little bit more to it.
Mm.
So are you talking more about the fact that like maybe you feel like a failure if you don't like attain this kind of perfect Hollywood type love, or are you talking more about like widening the boundaries of what relationships should look like whether that's like more LGBT relationships, more polyamorous, just kind of expanding on what like even a relationship should be?
I think it's that there's an idea of what a family should look like, and there's an idea of what or there's actually a genuine understanding of what goes into something loving. I don't necessarily mean that there's not enough. I mean, that, you know, I could argue that there isn't maybe enough openness or acceptance of openness. I'm not sure. I know that like, you know, I'm in a relationship right now, and I'm really understanding the benefits of a truly, you know, loving and committed relationship. But I know that like on my path or my journey towards understanding that part of myself, or it's like I just don't know if it's really emphasized how tough that can be for some people. So what I mean is like therapy I've done, from like the research I've read or the studies I've done, a few retreats and stuff like that, or quite often relationships are tough because they are reflective of what you experience as a child, and you grow so much from navigating that. But if you trip up along the way, or if you're starting from a different standpoint to someone else, I feel as though you're sometimes pushed away from the idea of love. Do you know what I'm trying to say? I don't know if I'm explaining myself very well.
No, I think it's, you're explaining it really well. And also in like mainstream culture, of if we are talking about like the way love is depicted in TV and films and stuff, yeah. I feel like the ending is always like they lived happily ever after,
yeah.
And it always ends on a wedding, and it's like, no, the hard bit is like, the hard bit isn't falling in love and getting someone, the hard bit is like 10-20 years of,
yeah,
staying together and
talking.
Why don't we talk about that bit?
Yeah,
I think also there's a sense when you watch Hollywood films of like the good guy and the bad guy, or the good girl and the bad girl. So it's like, they'll be like, maybe, you know, the most classic would be like the main female, and she's got like the really bad guy who she really likes, but then she discovers the really good guy. And actually, yeah, like the reality is in relationships, like people can be shitty to each other. And I've had some relationships where I'd be like, he was a dick. But actually the reality is I was probably a bit of a dick too. And it's never that simple of like one person being stomped on. I mean, I'm sure there are obviously like horrifically abusive relationships, yeah, where there's a lot of accountability more on one person's side. But the norm for like the everyday relationship, the more normal ones, is that both people have this kind of dynamic between them, which just becomes broken due to their own individual personalities. And it's not, yeah, just one person is evil and one person is the innocent, which I feel like that is like a massive pressure to like label one as the good and one as the bad, and yeah, who's the dumped, massive, and who's the dumpy. And
also like if we talk about like specifically the Hollywood aspect of it, we then move into conversations around like what we would deem as like, say, chivalry, you know? So you have, there's almost like a narrative, a scripted idea of what a grounded, you know, reliable man can do. But it's so, in my mind anyway, it's incredibly material. You know, there's, it's like a set of rules. You know, you open the door, you move out the chair, you pay for the meal, you go to work, you look, take care of yourself, maybe from a financial aspect.
Yeah.
And I think relationships that are based around capital and based around kind of like a financial achievement or I don't know. I just think that it loses what I now have grown to believe is the true aspect of love, the connection between two people, and understanding a support system. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of guys, especially because of Hollywood and other things, have believed that by accumulating power, for example, they might be able to gain the attention of certain women. And then there are some women who are complicit in that idea too.
But then I think it flips, doesn't it? Because men maybe have this pressure of like, if you are successful, if you make money, if you like are doing well in life, then, you know, you're going to be attractive to women, which is true for some women. But on the other hand, like women are portrayed as like, well, if you look beautiful and if you're kind of little and quirky and kind of a bit scatty, but also really fun and kind of just look really, really gorgeous. And I don't know, that then means that that's your kind of currency, certainly, yeah, in like, well, that's, kind, yeah, of Hollywood.
Also, do they teach like love, what is love, in schools? I don't think they do, do they? Like,
no. Well, I actually just did a course.
Don't you? But
you get
not love.
Taught like the mechanics of sex, but you never get taught yeah, like that's what people do when they're in love.
There's an amazing charity called Tender who I recently did a workshop with. I was invited down by some amazing people, and they're doing that. They're trying to go into schools because that's actually a preemptive. Yeah. That's in preemption of domestic abuse, actually. Because of that misunderstanding of power dynamics
and people can say this is love when actually it's abuse.
Exactly.
I feel like something I wish I'd known as a kid, and I think this is probably true for men too, but predominantly women, is like when I was young, when I was in a relationship, there was a tendency, there's a pattern that often comes in a relationship where one person is like being a little bit more the needy one, yeah, and the other person is a bit like, oh my God, stop nagging me, like I'm out with my friends, whatever.
Yeah.
And like, I was definitely in that relationship like at 15, and I was like, and I used to be like, oh my God, I totally take the blame for myself, I'm the needy one and I've got to just back off and give him space. And I wish I'd known then that yes, I was being needy, but he was also feeding into that by being unavailable. And yeah, it is, again, it's that it's not one person's characteristic. I'm not needy in my relationships now at all.
Yeah.
But I had to learn that that was because when you start being needy, ask why. Like, what is that person not giving you that makes you feel like that? And get out.
Yeah.
Or change, you know, or talk to them and see if you can change it.
Because you're not needy necessarily if you don't feel you have to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just think if there was a place in which people felt unafraid to just simply explain truly and honestly what was going through their mind and body, or even given an attempt to just sit with it, then I think there would be so much more progress rather than falling short being an attack on what we conceptually consider to be a relationship.
What would you like to see Hollywood doing more of them? If they're going to write romances and love stories, what do you think we need more of? And maybe even you'd write one yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think there's, it would be lovely to see, a shift in narrative, general narrative of power, more equality, like a power equality in relationships. Not necessarily there being a financial element and that being, being divvied between men and women. And also I'd just, you know, those films where you see the root of something, where you see someone genuinely overcoming a cycle. So for example, if you're born into a family, from what I've heard and seen and experienced a little bit myself. But if you're born into a family, say where there's like one absent parent, right? Like that can lead into, if you're not given space to understand the effects that has, you can end up in a cycle that you're not even aware of. And you can end up being unavailable for loads of people. But in that unavailability, you fall into a narrative of someone who is not good at relationships, or a bit of a dick, or like someone that, you know, is just like a waste of time. Mm-hmm. And I think some people end up just living into that narrative because they haven't got any other options. Mm-hmm. Whereas if there was
and
a story.
Happy.
Yeah, exactly. People they're not doing it out of
having the dream and just going off and being a little bit of a cad, but actually.
It's not always very comfortable. And I think if there was a story where someone acknowledged that and overcame, made their own choices that wasn't necessarily based on a void, that was actually based on a feeling of fullness and a conscious choice, that would be interesting to me.
I feel like you could write this, Jordan.
I think that would be really interesting because I do think that it's very easy to just like stereotype and fall into the easy trap of like, oh, they're just unavailable because they're a dick. It's like, no. So much going on beneath that.
Yeah. And I think it's, and you often end up attracting people as well that remind you that I did one thing where,
right, yeah,
they call even the word familiarity is supposedly rooted in the word family, you know?
Yeah.
So like when you fall in love or what we consider to be falling in love, you go like, oh, I feel like I've known you forever.
Yeah.
You know, it's because they are reminding you unconsciously of patterns that you're used to. And that can sometimes be damaging if you haven't, you have been given space.
There was a really interesting study, and it showed that women who had alcoholic fathers, you would have thought, like, rationally speaking, they would have seen the damage that being with an alcoholic caused for their mother and for them as a family, and they would have like steered clear of anyone, but like actually it made in them a kind of like desire, they sought out and they ended up, a lot of them, with people with that same problem with alcoholism, because what they were hoping that the theory is anyway, they were trying to create the same story but change the ending. So it was awful with him, but I'm going to find someone, I'm going to marry them, I'm going to save them, I'm going to fix them, and I'm going to provide the happy ending that I never got in my childhood. So it's that kind of gosh, we could talk about this for so much longer. That's such an interesting.
But I just think it would be lovely culturally for there to be, all I'm saying is for there to be space.
Yeah.
Just to discuss honestly, because sometimes painfully honestly, the nuances of coming out of an unconventional upbringing and not being seen as less than in society. I mean, bear in mind, you get given tax relief for being married now in our society, which is, I understand, but it is exposing of how we've mutated an idea. You know, marriage wasn't birthed out of romance. It was birthed out of hierarchy and status and
ownership, but ownership of women as well.
Ownership.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes. You give up your name, you become the property your father gives you to your husband.
Literally. I want people to love out of choice and not fear. That's nothing.
Yeah.
It's not fear of the consequence of things, fear of punishment, but out of a choice because they, you know, truly love another person.
Yeah. So Liana, what's your topic to get off your breasts?
So I suppose this is quite topical. This happened recently. We all watched in horror as the news footage and on social media as Notre Dame quite literally burned. And it was really shocking. It was, you know, really sad to see this beautiful building of such historic value and obviously so sort of important to the French people and their identity of Paris. And everyone's got memories of it, and, you know, all the rest of it. And initially it was like, oh my God, this is awful. And, you know, they were talking about the fact that 13,000 trees went to build this. It was built in the 12th century. And then all the money started pouring in. So then we had like this billionaire offering 100 million euros. Then Yves Saint Laurent offering da 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 da. And basically like all this money started pouring in. And then the recrimination started and people were like, hold a minute, how can we be spending like 300 million or I don't even know how much it was, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions on a building when there are people literally dying on the streets, right? And again, I was like, yes, this is so true. Oh my God, this is awful. Then I started thinking about it a little bit further. And this is where I kind of like go to my third layer. And this is where I want to throw it to you two, which is that, so I co-founded this charity a long time ago, 4 years ago now, called Help Refugees, and we worked obviously as it says on the tin with refugees. And I no longer work there day to day. An amazing team run it, but at the time I was doing a lot of like media stuff, and I was getting so many comments coming in with people going like, how can you be helping refugees when we've got a homeless problem here? Or the other one was, how can you be helping refugees when there are children in this country who are living in poverty? And I was always saying to them, hold a minute, it's not either or, first of all. There is enough money in the world to help everyone. There is enough potential in the world to help everyone if the will is there, right? So the fact that someone decides to give £10 to help refugees and we give that to make soup for a refugee does not like directly take that from the pot that they were going to give a homeless person. It doesn't work like that. I don't sit there and go, do I want to help a refugee or a homeless person today with my £10? It doesn't work like that. What happens is you feel a connection to a cause and you go, and it may be, you know, maybe something to do with a species, an animal issue. Someone might go, well, they're not as important as humans. Or it may be, you know, whatever it is that appeals to your heart. And I used to come back to people and go, it doesn't work like that. So then I was like, well, why shouldn't I apply that to Notre Dame? And like, yes, I do. Like, I personally think like preserving a building over human life, yeah, of course it's wrong. But at the same time, those people would not have dug into their pockets and given that to homeless or refugees or cancer charity, whatever else, because for whatever reason, which is up to, you know, they have to, you know, live with themselves and ask themselves those questions, why it didn't spur them on. It's not one pot that was being stolen from. So I kind of at that point wanted to ask your guys your opinion, because I've almost gone back round and flipped round on myself going, we can't criticize people. If they want to give to a cause, that is their choice. And maybe it's sad that they want to give to this cause over that one, but let it be. I don't know.
I think it does expose the kind of reality of the situation, which is people give money to things they feel emotionally attached to. Mm-hmm. And I wish it wasn't the case, but people feeling an emotional connection to like a part of history that's close to them on their doorstep. Even people in England being like, I went to Paris for my 1 year anniversary and I have this selfie in front of the Notre Dame, blah, 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 blah.
It's, oh God, like, the selfies. Everyone's like, it's me.
But then at the same time, people give money to things that feel close to them. And does that make people horrible? I don't know.
I think for me, the actual insult wasn't necessarily in people giving money. It was the speed at which they gave money.
Mm.
And also it was the fact it was two people. So it wasn't necessarily like there was a collection. It wasn't a collective thing of like, oh, everyone's raised money for this, but not for that. It was like two people who were just going about their business, just dropped 300 mil, like in a day. Yeah. Like, and the question is, how are you just knocking about with 300 mil? How many things do you see in the news where 300 million euros just, you're just not going anywhere near it? And I do think that like there is, and definitely I agree with what you're saying, in a world that is ultimately ravished with tragedy, it is impossible, actually impossible, to save everyone. Like it, you have to do what you can for your community. But I think it's considering how close it is to Grenfell, another building that burned down with people in it, like with hundreds of people inside. I just asked the question, like where are our equivalents of that design company? Like, why, think how many millionaires, do you know, in London, for example, we have more billionaires than any other capital city.
But that's the point, isn't it? It's not about going, well, Yves Saint Laurent, you're a dick for giving the money to Notre Dame and not to help the people who are living homeless in the streets of Paris. It's about going, why aren't there people in the world whose heart are touched by these human tragedies, who have this money? Because there are so many people that have this money, clearly, that can just drop it and fix something. Or not fix it, because you can't, you know, people have died, you can't take that back, but who can really, really help to, you know, and they're not. And why is that? Why is that not resonating with people in that same way, with that amount of money?
Do they feel more removed from it? Or is it just like the way we're sold tragedy, like posters on the tube? It's not going there and seeing it firsthand.
It's like too confronting almost, isn't it? Like, it's exposing of another part of our humanity, which is in that, you know, Notre Dame is a beautiful building, but its heritage is, you know, it becomes conceptual in a way. And all of us as human beings, we choose concepts often over human life in a way that, like, people will fight for England, right? But if tomorrow we change the name to New France, no, like, who, it's just an idea.
But the only thing that remains is
the land.
That's identity though as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think particularly that this sense of identity is very strong in France. And I think Notre Dame, the Eiffel Tower, you know, these certain historic buildings are a really important part of that sort of French identity. But I was wondering like, what would have happened if, like, say for example, Big Ben burned down or something? Like, would we have had any problem with it being rebuilt, even though it cost a lot of money? And would people have said, well, actually, Big Ben is one of the reasons that all these tourists flock to the UK, is part of that, and that brings in a hell of a lot of economy. So I don't know. But I mean, don't get me wrong, if I was a billionaire, I would not be choosing to do what Yves Saint Laurent or this other billionaire did. I think we are in danger of hierarching causes.
Yeah.
The thing that made me think was this poet, Charlie Cox. She wrote a poem. I'm not going to paraphrase it badly, but it was something like, we care more about rebuilding our history than we do about building the future. Yeah. So like, why wouldn't you put more millions into like climate change than rebuilding an old building?
But then, okay, so I 100% agree with that. And I was like, reading that, and it really touched a nerve. But again, like, where does that end then? Because could you then go, well, hold on, don't give to a cancer charity, give to a teenage cancer charity because they're more deserving, and then hold on, don't give to a teenage cancer charity because you've got to give to, there are babies, and like, how do you draw a line and go, know, like, this is the most worthy cause in the world, we can only support this one, everything else has to take second place. It's hard.
But I know what you're saying, and I think the only thing I think for me personally, the correlation was Grenfell, really. Yeah. That was what hit home. I think it seemed ridiculous on the basis that a lot of Notre Dame has been saved, and that's an incredibly large sum of money in an incredibly short space of time.
Yeah.
But it's just the parallel is too much. You know, it's just like, we know that people is, and also it just reminds us that we go about our everyday business trying to get by. Actually, a lot of us giving money to charity.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Meanwhile, there are these super, super rich people who are just dwelling and whenever they want, they just, dip, you know, oh, you know what? I'll go. And I don't think, like I said, I don't think you can save anyone, but you can change the levels of compassion, or you can change the importance. So I think what it is importance. Maybe it's like it's that a building can be instantly so important. I don't know.
But you're right. It's like,
I know what you mean about charities, though. I really do agree with you on that.
But then at the same time, I do go like, there's no way that you could ever say that a building is more important than a human life or any life. And why is it that these people with all this money like have more kind of connection? And they can spend their money how they want. It's their money, right? That's, you know, it's better than that they spend it on something that they just keep it in their pockets and splash it on yachts or whatever. But why do they feel moved to spend it on a historic building and not to a building where lives were lost, like Grenfell? That's the question, isn't it? And that's quite sad.
To play devil's advocate, I think, you know, you walk past Notre Dame every day if you live in Central Paris, which, by the way, is fucking expensive. So that makes a lot of sense already. But like, you know, and it is a massive aspect of a Parisian identity. So I do understand a feeling of loss. I don't think that's out of the question for someone to feel related in some way to an inanimate object.
It'll pull on the heartstrings.
Yeah, I do understand people. That. And maybe on the basis that it's based on your own subjective idea, that's why you're more drawn to it, because you're not having to conflict with a reality. If Notre Dame could think or speak, then it might bring into question what people's love for it, you know, in the same way we're drawn to animals, or pets. Part of me thinks it's because they just can't say shit. Like, you know, because impose. Yeah. Imprint your perspective or your idea of self onto something that won't be able to ever answer back. So the real question is, if Notre Dame could speak, would he tell the Bolognese or she, would it be like, I'm not bothered?
See all these homeless people sleeping outside, sort them out first.
Do you know what I'm saying?
I like my new look.
What we should do is try and create a story where Notre Dame is just a person. Because then it'd be interesting to see what Notre Dame would say to being saved in that scenario.
I have to say, I almost feel like I would have felt more ill about it if it had been like a crowdfunded thing and like ordinary people had put into it, because I would have felt like, why aren't those people crowdfunding for like a really like for human life or, you know, whatever, species survival, save our planet. But I think, the fact that it was these two guys that just decided that was their thing was,
I think it's really interesting what you just said there about how I don't think many people know that like 10 people own everything in the world.
Didn't they just come out 1% of the population own half the land in England?
There's loads of like monarchs and that, innit? Like all the lords and shit. They got loads of space.
It makes me feel so ill, because it just means that we're all here just doing our thing, and there's just people owning everything at the top.
Who could fix so much? It's like you said, you could probably cure cancer, or, you know, do something really significant if all those people just went dug into their like gold bars, just sitting rotting in some room somewhere.
It's like a Bug's Life. You know that film on Bug's Life where he does that scene where he's like dropping the like little nuts or acorns on the grasshoppers, and then the whole theme is like, if you don't attack these bugs, they will realize that they outnumber you by like an unbelievable amount. So every time we talk about politics, right, I always just have it in the back of my mind, just like a little voice just says, maybe anarchy is the answer. Like,
the revolution is coming.
No, just because if we actually were that upset about something and everyone wasn't so trapped in capitalism and just stopped.
Yeah.
I always think that would change.
If
everyone just, you know what I mean?
A Bug's Life.
If you just stopped, if everyone
I can't believe we've got from Notre Dame to Bug's Life. I love that. I love this, how we go on these tangents.
Yeah, but I do know what you mean. I think it's just, I think for some people it's heartbreak, because you wish that people who had material money and societal power, do you wish that they would have almost inherently a desire to drop that money on? Yeah.
And do you know what? Maybe they are also giving to charity. You know, who knows?
Maybe they're just like absolutely paralyzed by the choice of who the hell do I give this to?
Yeah, exactly.
And also,
or maybe they like the idea of being the saviors of France. Like, we saved Paris, we saved France. You know, who knows?
Also,
who
knows? There is also the danger that they just don't care. When you're talking about the 1% thing, it's like sometimes I see there's if you can find the Twitters of like certain people who are like billionaires, and the way they talk about stuff.
Maybe they're psychopaths.
Well, like, if you talk about like Rupert Murdoch or people of that level, right?
Psychopaths.
I mean, I haven't met him, but I can guess. But like the people of that level, right? They honestly, when we're talking about this stuff, Brexit, this book, back and forth, like, below. It doesn't. Honestly, I look at it, they're just like, they'll do tweets just to each other, these 10 people, just going like,
this inner like billionaire tweet.
Do you know what I mean? They'll just look at it and they'll just be like, hey, you guys checked out Vice magazine, or like, hey, you guys checked out National Geographic. And then who are they talking to? Hey, you guys checked out National Geographic. They're like, have you looked at this massive like empire that of television that everyone consumes? I might just dip into that. Do you know what I mean?
I just read John Ronson.
They own islands.
I just read John Ronson's The Psychopath Test, which basically is like, all these powerful people are psychopaths. And so I think that's why. They just,
yeah, it's like, 3% of CEOs?
Yeah, they just like the national
power.
Something that I've noticed is that people expect other people to do free work, free labor off the back of like doing a favor for feminism. So at the moment it's like a personal thing where people and get me to do free stuff by saying like, hey Emma, because you know you're part of the sisterhood, we'd really appreciate it if you could like come down to this event and like unpaid work basically. And also people saying, you know, to a feminist from another feminist. But it's always like a big corporation trying to get money. This isn't like a charity thing. This isn't like an actual friend asking for help. Those things I would definitely do. But it's also around International Women's Day when there's like this white guy at the top who basically gets their female junior employees to like put on this International Women's Day breakfast or whatever, and they don't get paid. And I put on Instagram ages ago this like quote just saying, you know, by the way, everyone, if you're going to ask anyone to do anything for feminism, like make sure you pay them. Because what's more empowering than paying people? And the amount of people that kind of like slid into my DMs being like, I work at X massive company and I have to do all this empowering women stuff on the side for free. So I just wanted to talk about that and how it's almost like a guilt trip of like, help women but work for free.
Which is almost like the polar opposite of what it should be, because like part of the issue for equality for women is that they don't get paid
someone's making money off it, and it's definitely not the women. I mean, that's it, that's what I wanted to say.
That's like it's the commodification of like individual freedom.
Yeah,
isn't it?
It's like, let's put a hashtag on it and get people to come along and do it on top of your job. I think that's what really annoys me, is that there's so many people out there who are just given extra work all the time for like the cause.
And I suppose the frustration is a sense of guilt in saying no.
Yeah. And I suppose I feel guilty when I say no. But if you're doing like a branded event around empowerment, someone is making money off this. And it's not enough for me to just say, I'm a feminist, so I'm going to come along and work.
It's hard to say no to that kind of stuff. So I've made content in the past for broadcasters when I've been working in part of a job, and I've made like extra content for like Women's Day or whatever else. And I think if you say like, well, no, I don't want to do that unless I'm being paid, you feel like, oh, hold on, but the people I'm withholding it from are the women who would listen to this and benefit, or the men who would listen to this and, you know, become a bit more knowledgeable, a bit more informed. And you feel like, well, we should all do a bit, but you're right. If someone's making money off it and they're not paying women, that is like one of the core problems that we have to deal with.
I think
this is controversial, but I believe that activists should get paid. I think that you can be stuck in a very vicious, like dangerous cycle if people just think, oh, they'll do all that stuff for free.
Well, it's something I often see. There are women of color on Instagram in particular who I follow, and they're like incredibly, you know, knowledgeable, educated women who are like sharing insights into how to kind of dismantle white supremacy and into racism. And they
one of the kind of messages I keep seeing them saying again is, you need to pay me for my education. Like, it's all very well that I'm doing this work, but I need to pay my bills. And part of the whole problem is like Black people working and not being paid properly and like other people benefiting off the back of it. So it kind of feels like across the field, like whether it's feminism, whether it's racism, whether it's an LGBT issue, if someone's kind of taking advantage of the fact that you're trying to dismantle a kind of oppressive system by getting you to come to my company and give me this, or like make this content for me that I'm then going to make adverts from, like, that is massively part of the problem.
And also leading back to the Notre Dame thing, there were some t-shirts on sale. Loads of merch came out the woodwork after Notre Dame. I don't know if you noticed, but it was like loads of people were tweeting it, just being like, are any of these profits for these t-shirts that say like, we love Notre Dame or whatever, that's suddenly been made overnight, are they going to anywhere? And they weren't.
Yeah, I don't know. I think like, I don't feel like there's an answer to that, really. Can you just like say no?
Yeah, I can say no, but I just feel bad for the people that like don't feel they can say no.
Yeah.
And if they work for their scary boss who say, hey girls, we're doing a feminist takeover on Friday for our clients to talk about empowering women. You have to stay till 9 PM, but we don't have any budget because we're doing it for women. That's the feedback I got. These women in companies being like, we feel trapped and we're having to work overtime for this cause.
Yeah, it's tough. I think like it's about having confidence to have your boundaries, really, isn't it? I don't have that experience. I might have some variation of it based on being mixed race. I think I've been asked to do diversity talks before, but to be honest, I've asked for quite a lot of money because I'm like, I'm going to do a corporate thing. And the second it's corporate,
well, that's it.
It's
that's
like, you got to give me the money. Like, cause I'm not going to, I don't know. You're ticking a quota. You're going, oh shit. Like, it's popping off online. I need our clients and our staff to feel seen, you know?
It's expertise, isn't it?
Yeah. But I think it's like, I don't know. I feel like there needs to just be an understanding that everyone's entitled to that boundary, maybe. And then
and that comes with age, I think, as well, a little bit, and experience. Because I think when you first get asked to do those things when you're quite young, you're a bit like, who, me?
Yeah.
I feel so honored. And then after like, I don't know, 10 years ago, you're like, show me the money.
Yeah, maybe. But maybe this.
Are you frustrated by like the energy behind it? Like the fact that people can even dare do that shit?
Well, I just don't like that they frame it in a way that makes me feel like I'm cornered, and that if me saying no makes me a bad person, makes me not feminist or something. I think it's just an interesting one in terms of like activists getting paid and where the line is and what do you do for free, what do you don't. I don't know. I also think it's a relatively new problem. When I worked in an office, no one really spoke about feminism. No one was trying to make money off it. I think we're in a time where, I don't know, people try and corner you into doing extra work for free.
Yeah, I definitely vouch for the commodification of political identity is like really dangerous, because it's absolute, you know. And like you can have someone who ultimately, like, one of my first educations off the back of the Me Too campaign was I read this article maybe from a woman in Harvard, studied at Harvard. I'm not sure. Anyway, I'm pretty sure it was on that website. But it was making a very clear point, something I felt I actually played into, which was like the instant faux feminist. Do you know what I mean? Who could pretty much wear a t-shirt, like literally a t-shirt, like could wear a t-shirt being like, with some kind of thing on it, like pussy is amazing, or you know what I mean? Or like, and then you just like roll in, and then you're just looking to do exactly the same thing, but just from a position of being conscious, in inverted commas. You know what I mean? Like, you could just be like, oh yeah, yeah, I get it, man. Like, yeah, men are like being awful and stuff. And like, you know, anyway, what are you doing later? Do you know what I mean? That kind of thing. And I think it's making sure that those people are held accountable too. And like I say, I put my hands up, like, that was something I think I very almost really played into, and then realized that actually the, you know, best thing I could do was take a look at my own actions. But there was a point where you could easily just walk into a room and just point fingers. Mm-hmm. Like, that's bad. That's bad. Am I right, girls? Like, fuck that guy. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? But it's like, you have to have a look at your own. I don't know how you would do that in the context of, I get the thing with Black History Month for that. And a lot of my friends stand up to that. October comes around. I even suggested a fucking exhibition once for my friend, who's a black artist. And they were like, oh, well, we'll have a look at October. I was like, come on.
Oh my God.
No.
I was like, come on. Do you know what I mean? It's like, and when October comes around, I know for a fact that like I'm in this incredible collective called 6 Weeks, and they, so, you know, a lot of the time they'll like consciously be like absolutely like shut down because it's like you're it's all expected. It's exactly what you're saying. That's actually exactly what you're saying. I've just realized
exactly
that.
Exactly what I'm saying because it's 1 month that you get.
Yeah, and then suddenly the expectations on like right, okay, so we got to show solidarity here. So
it's a powerful person at the top going, we need to show our clients that we care. So roll up your sleeves, everyone, and tick some boxes.
Yeah, and that is annoying.
And that is terrible.
When actually, what you could do is make a structural difference whenever you want.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and because exactly. You want to.
So is the issue actually our categorization of politically based events?
International Men's
Day. If money is being made, you have to, and then you should pay people, especially if they are people who, like, traditionally speaking, are not paid properly or have come from, like, a history of oppression, like, dig in, you know?
Yeah. Jordan, okay, well, thank you so much.
That was truly insightful. Is there anything you want to plug really quickly? Because you're here on our podcast and, you know, you've been very kind to come and talk to us.
If you look up 6 Weeks, the Creative Collective, that's SXWKS, on Instagram, there's just a whole clique of people doing incredible things. Very inspiring.
Amazing.
Well, that's it for this episode. Our thanks to Jordan Stevens, of course, to Shola Aleje for producing this episode, and to you for listening. If you have enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes or wherever you happen to be listening. It really is very useful for other people to find us, and we really appreciate it. And do join us for another episode next week when we'll be joined by the brilliant Viv Grosskopf.